The following podcast contains explicit language.
Welcome to the XX Gabfest for Thursday, May 31st, the Manic Pixie Murderer Edition. I'm Hannah Rosen, a host of NPR's Invisibilia, and in the New York studios, we have June Thomas, Senior Managing Producer of Slate Podcast Network. Hi, June.
Hey, Hannah.
And Noreen Malone of New York Magazine. Hi, Noreen.
Hi, Hannah.
So, geez, Roseanne and her racism. What the hell? That was an immediate, fast cancellation of her show. Wow.
Yeah, I mean, the sad thing is I was not surprised by the racism. I was surprised by the swiftness and happy about the swiftness of the cancellation. She's been sort of dog whistling for months and months and months. And it was amazing. Like, this is a profit-making show. And the head of ABC, who, by the way, I believe is the first black head of a
first
network.
First black woman, yeah.
Yeah. Was like, nope. Not going to put up with it, which is pretty great.
I mean, I was very happy with the swift action, but I have to say, like, what did you think? Like, had you noticed that she'd tweeted before? Because before the show started, she tweeted some heinous things, conspiracy theories, transphobic things, and was the fact that she got a show suddenly going to transform things? One of my friends who was at the TCA executive session panel, which is where the heads of the network, you know, take questions and give a little presentation, noted that Channing Dungey had said in answer to a question that she wasn't at all worried about Roseanne's Twitter feed, you know, when they were announcing Roseanne. And you know what? She should have been. This was, you know, talk about something that you could have predicted very easily. Could have predicted this very easily, but yeah. Still good for ABC.
Well, I'm sure that she was worried about it. She just couldn't say it in that. Yeah. And it's true that Disney's stock immediately dropped like 2.5 points,
wow.
Which is pretty crazy.
I did not know that.
Yeah, she's such an unforgivable idiot. You know, I mean, it's like she got what she wanted. She had this hit show. She could have stayed quiet. She said very similar racist things in the past, you know? And you know you can't get away with tweeting something so specific about such a specific person. Like, it's just, you know, general conspiracy theories is one thing. Saying something specifically about an Obama aide is another thing. It's just, ugh. Anyway, so our show for today, just to clear up the confusion, we, June, Noreen, and I are definitely still going to be on this podcast. We're just adding new voices to the show. You heard some of them last week, and you will continue to hear more, but don't worry, we're not going anywhere. We are still part of the cast. Thank you, guys. We're looking for a new name, as we put out there. You guys are just pun masters, also masters of feminist history. It's amazing. I'm going to read a couple off our chests that time of the week. This one's flattering to you guys. Gorgeous Ladies of Slate. Gloss. And then there's all the like phallus malice cliterature 101.
Phallus Malice, man, is our punk band.
Exactly. We really, in all the names that you amazing listeners have sent us, we will manage to do a podcast, a punk band, a fashion house, and a feminist collective. There are just so many possibilities in these names. We haven't quite settled yet. Keep sending them if you have any more. But our clock is ticking, and we will have a name very soon. All right, our topics for today. First, we're going to talk about My Favorite Murder, a comedy murder podcast that's also a giant support network. We discuss female obsession with true crime. Second, Ireland votes to legalize abortion, a huge moment in the country's history we discuss. And finally, the BBC show Killing Eve and the trope of the cold-blooded murderess. Then in our Slate Plus segment, where we take a topic and discuss 1 to 10, is it sexist? We are going to talk about, Noreen, tell us what we're going to talk about.
We are going to talk about whether it's sexist that people are more obsessed with slagging Barry Weiss and Maggie Haberman, of both of the New York Times, of the opinion section and the news section, than their male counterparts.
Okay, let's move on to our first topic, My Favorite Murder, a spectacularly popular murder comedy podcast, which is powered by a huge support network made up largely of women. Karen Kilgariff and Georgia Hardstark are the hosts. They talk about their therapists, their relationships, but mostly they talk in exquisite detail about murderers and rapists and the efforts or failed efforts to capture them. The show's success puts in the open what was mostly subtle before, which is that there's something particular about the female obsession with true crime in all its forms. To discuss this today, we have a special guest with us, journalist and podcaster Rebecca Lavoie, who hosts Crime Writers On and Mom and Dad Are Fighting. Hi, Rebecca.
Hey, guys. How are you?
Good. I'm going to call you guys murderinos through this whole thing just to bother you. Is that okay?
Stay on brand.
Because I know it's going to bother June and Noreen.
And please
just
don't.
To irritate them.
Please don't.
I am not a murderino.
You're not a murderino. Okay, Rebecca, I'll start with you. How would you characterize the show? Like, what is distinct about the show? For someone who podcasts on this topic, what makes this show distinctive? Or how do people connect to it?
Well, it's a chat show. Is what it is. It's not an investigative show. It's not actually solving anything or looking at anything in a new way. In fact, I know that one of the criticisms that gets weighed at the show sometimes is that they're, you know, basically reading Wikipedia or other articles and just reacting to them when they sort of go down the road of like giving the details of a crime story. And, you know, they aren't doing anything new with these stories except creating a conversation around them. They're not even dissecting the media per se around these stories. It really is just a chat show. It's like the opening segment to, you know, old school Regis and Kathy Lee, where they just like sat around and read the paper and talked about what they did last night, except the conceit here, the conversation starter is rape and murder and, you know, serial killers. That's kind of what it gets wrapped around. It's a personality driven show. And I think that the cult around it is really driven by that cult of personality that has developed around the show.
Okay, so Noreen or June, since I know what you guys think, because you couldn't help yourselves but spill all over in text form this week as we were preparing. So, okay, Rebecca just described what it is. What irritates you so much about it?
I found it repulsive, actually. That was the word as I was listening to the first episode that kept coming into my head. And some of that is like just aesthetic preference. I do not think it's a well-done podcast. You could probably say that about ours, but whatever. I think ours is different.
What do you mean? Like it's too loose or what's the problem?
I think it's weird to have a comedy podcast about murder. I think it's weirder to have a comedy podcast that's not funny. To me, what's interesting about, like, I will read detective thrillers, and to me, my interest is in, like, the precision of detail and unspooling the logic of the crime. There's a kind of, like, this is, like, a weird combination of these women think they are so much funnier than they are, and then, like, prurient details about people's deaths. I also kept thinking of it as, like, hipster Nancy Grace, right? The cases that they're interested in are the sort of like ripped from the tabloids, pretty blonde woman gets murdered. Now, I didn't listen to all of them. I don't know. But it tended to be that sort of like really like almost like a glamorous kind of murder. And that bothered me, right? Like, it's become a trope to make fun of Nancy Grace or to say that Nancy Grace is just, like, sensationalizing things. But this was actually, it's actually doing the same kind of work as Nancy Grace, where it's like, you know, these women talking about how it's almost like putting themselves in the shoes of the victim, right? But there's a weird kind of narcissism to that. It's like, if I were murdered, it wouldn't be in the normal way. It would be in this, like, very special way where the sicko targeted me because I'm such a special white woman. I don't know. I had this, like, total allergic reaction to it. What about you, Jen?
I was not quite so allergic. I did not like it. It is not a show for me. It's not something I will listen to. I didn't find them funny, which I guess, you know, if you're going to choose whether or not to listen to a comedy podcast, it should be one that you find funny. And I did not find this funny. However, having, you know, read up in the way that we do, because unlike these women, we actually do some preparation. Amanda Hess's piece about My Favorite Murder was somewhat convincing to me. She talked about how like the blah, blah at the beginning, because they go on and on and on about nothing for about 20 minutes before they get to the, you know, Wikipedia reading. It is,
and it,
you know,
truly is Wikipedia reading.
It is.
Said that, hey, this, you know, she kind of looked on the good side of it and said, this places these crimes, like, it shows, hey, you know, we're kind of contextualizing this in life. And so, okay, you know, it's, again, not for me, but okay, I see that a little
Wait,
bit.
Wait, what does that mean, contextualizing?
So that, like, we're not just talking about murders. We're going to talk about our life, and we're going to show that there are things in life that are more important than murders.
But, like, someone else's grisly, tragic death is not a vehicle for you to talk about, like, your CBD vape pen. I don't know. Like, I don't buy that. I think there are other ways for people to bond about anxiety and mental health, which is something that people have also said about this podcast. So it's nice that they talk about those things. Sure. But, like, ultimately what you're doing is glorifying someone else's death and not even doing a very good job at it. And it's like, I don't know.
Hannah, come in and defend this show.
All right. So I think that you are being a little literal-minded about this podcast. It's not... It doesn't do a lot of work on crimes. Although I have to say, they do bring up topics and they do have hosts. So they will talk specifically about, like, what's going on in DNA evidence, and they'll invite people on. So I think the Wikipedia thing is actually kind of unfair. They do talk about trends in crime fighting and why certain things were happening or not happening. And they kind of develop a body of expertise, even though their shtick is not like, I did a lot of research and this is what I discovered. That's not what they do. They're essentially creating a safe, like a safe spacey kind of show. It's not Nancy Grace because it is making it, I think it taps into a part of a lot of women, like a part that feels like something happened to them and they were scared and they don't know what to do with it, and it's uncool to connect with it. And then this becomes a place where everybody comes and shares that part of themselves, and it's kind of cool and okay to do that. Mm-hmm. So I think that's the thing that fuels the show. It's not so much what's actually happening. It's just like the giant community that develops around it. My nervousness about it is that just in general, in like we are in a victim moment, like, you know, not that long ago, it was not cool to connect with the victim side of you. It wouldn't be the first thing that you would mention on a date or with your girlfriends or in public or write about. Now it is. It's like the culture has switched 180 degrees on victimhood and how we connect with it. And that's okay. But part of me is worried that maybe this becomes a language that you Well, two things, that you stay in for too long, like it's a part of you that you identify with, like maybe a little too much and too strongly and too completely, and this creates a space for that. And the second worry I have is kind of what you said, Noreen, is that I have noticed just in reporting that sometimes people's connection with their own pain totally blinds them to the reality of other people's pain. And listeners, I hear some of you turning off the show right now. Like, we forgot to say this at the top. We meant to say it like at things that we say are not forever. You know, it's I understand that that's a, like that. But that is just something I wonder about, that like you're here because that's so evident in this show that, like, yes, there's a community of victims. Yes, it's by women for women and they're connecting with the victims. But just like the way they talk, as you said, is sometimes really dismissive of somebody's actual reality. Like, they do think that it's the murder victims are kind of like fantastic and sparkly, you know?
I think too that there's kind of you know, the idea that this is somehow glorifying these crimes, I mean, or making light around these grisly murders, I think that's denying a basic human fact, which is that these conversations about serial killers, about, you know, serial rapists, about the Golden State Killer, about all these things that we're talking about very openly now in podcasts and in the media and on shows like this, these were already happening. They were happening at book clubs. They were happening at work, at the water cooler. They were happening in all kinds of communities of men and women. But, you know, women were already talking about these things in a way that was, dare I say, like a little gossipy or a little bit of a salacious, like juicy, oh my God, did you hear this kind of way? And this show is built on that. It's built on that conversation. It's built on the, you know, holy crap, can you believe, remember the Polly Klass case? I mean, it's built on that. That's like the engine that drives it. And it's not dissimilar, the fandom that it's inspired and the cult around it that's inspired from the non-ironic SVU fans. I mean, I see a lot of crossover there because... Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I'm an ironic SVU fan. I love the show. I just love it, love it, love it.
You know, I do too, Rebecca.
It's terrible.
yes.
But I love it. And yeah. I see, when I see people in the long defenses, because on my Facebook page, the like it's 50-50 split. Some people hate it. The people who love it, they talk about it exactly the same way people talk about Mariska Hargitay and how much SVU has done to inform people about the realities of sexual assault and consent. And it's the same kind of conversation, but it's also not made for me. It's made for like the non-ironic SVU fan or the non-ironic Dateline NBC fan. At least that's what I hear when I'm reading all of these, you know, loving defenses of it.
But isn't it? It's not like SVU. I mean, people connect with it more. It's not like Nancy Grace. It's like, okay, maybe you guys don't think it's hilarious. You know, it's not like Two Dope Queens, but it's...
No, there's nothing funny whatsoever. I mean, it's... But again, comedy is so subjective. Like, it's fine if I don't find it even vaguely funny. That's not... Like, that's okay. If other people do, that's all that matters. SVU, which is basically true crime once removed, is... It may, you know, you say, well, it doesn't have huge Facebook groups, but millions of people have been watching it for, what are we on, Rebecca, season 15 now?
19.
I mean, you know, so it's plenty popular, and I have never missed an episode. I watch it the week it airs. Like, I mean, it's crazy.
Wow.
You know, it's a very, very, it's a show that has a lot of fans. I want to talk about one thing that we kind of gestured at and didn't, a lot of the kind of pieces about the show talk about it as being exposure therapy. And I wonder to what extent that is true. I mean, you know, I definitely think that there, you know, something that you talked about, Hannah, of all of us, every single person, surely every single woman has at some point had some like, shit, something is going to happen right now. Maybe it did happen. Hopefully it didn't. But we've all been in that situation. So we all in some ways have been in touch with that primal fear of, oh my God, this something is going to go really bad now. And maybe talking about it, maybe hearing discussions of it every single week kind of help us deal with that. Like I was recently, I'm at an age now where I'm thinking about like what was obsessing me at various times in my life. And I remember when I was at college, like a good part of my mental space was taken up because the Yorkshire Ripper was doing his thing at the time. And he would, you know, where I went to university was in his range, and there was lots of discussion of, oh, it's the Goose Fair, which is a thing that happens in Nottingham every year. The Yorkshire Ripper will be here. And like, how much of my, like, it sounds ridiculous to even put that in words right now, but like, that ate up so much of my, like, life and my mental capacity. Like, that's ridiculous, but that was huge. And that is one of the things that, one of the maybe three things I can think of emotionally from that period of my life.
Right, right. But like, if you get murdered in America, it's not going to be as a victim of a serial killer. It's going to be as like collateral damage in this like larger system of inequality and racial injustice and like fucking lack of gun control, right? Like that's what's going to happen, but that's
right.
Not interesting, and it doesn't allow you, the listener, to place yourself in the shoes of the person who gets this weird amount of tension even in death. I mean, I want to go back to interrogating what you said about victimhood, Hannah, because I don't think it's exactly like the glorification of victimhood in such a straight ahead way, but I am interested in this like weird justification that people seem to want to have around just like, just say like, I'm interested in the grisly details of true crime. Like that's been true for forever. Like you said, Rebecca, that's part of humanity. But there's this thing where people need to justify it now, and I think it's because there is this hyper awareness in certain circles that like, yeah, Nancy Grace is maybe like not so great. And I really don't think
no, she's the worst. Stop couching it. She's the worst.
But there's not that much difference in the strings that they're tugging on. I mean, it's like they, you know, oh, so you need to be aware. What are you being aware of here?
But like, they're not indicting innocent people, which Nancy Grace does all the time, or people that haven't been tried or convicted. That's the Nancy Grace problem. Nancy Grace problem isn't the glorification of crime. It's the glorification of prosecution. That's not what My Favorite Murder does. I don't
also think. The fans own this show. It's not like SVU. It's not like a slick production. It's not, you know, it's not some news show. It's not Dateline. Like it's not, it's just like a bunch of fans basically talking about the things they're afraid of. That's why people like this show.
Okay, so you walk around worrying that you're going to be raped and murdered all the time. How does that change the way you behave in the world? Do you like, do you profile people? Maybe you do, you know, like there, it just gets you into this mindset that I think is personally unhealthy. One, that's not to say that people who have been, you know, people who've been victims of violence of all kinds process it in different ways. And there's been some coverage of that as you know, why people are drawn to the show. But that I don't think is every single listener to this show. I think there's a lot of like, projection. And I think it's a weird, unhealthy projection. And I think that we should, that like the sort of middle class and upper middle class women who seem to be projecting themselves in this particular instance should examine what it is that like we're doing here, why we think our tragedy would be more special and tragic than everyone else's.
So we had a listener, Teresa, who wrote in about all the good things that come out of the show, like how when murderinos get together, they end up raising money for you know, causes like End the Backlog, about rape kits, and, you know, people who, like murderinos who have written in and said, oh, I because of the show, I was aware of this dangerous situation and I helped this other woman. Or, you know, there's like, I don't know if the net result is to make you more scared, more likely to racially and otherwise profile people, and just much more likely to walk around the earth terrified because you're thinking about this all the time, or if it's to make you feel comforted and safe and part of a giant community
and empowered.
Who,
I mean, one of the things that like my listeners have said about it who love it is that there are a lot of messages about how, you know, women tend to not trust their gut. Women tend to apologize to strangers for bumping into them when they weren't the one who did the bumping. And there's that kind of conversation that's come from it, which is why it reminds me of the SVU meta conversation so much, because of that whole, like, you know, lesson learning, female empowerment. I mean, I'm not saying that that's what I get from the like four episodes that I've actually listened to in the lifetime of the history of the show, but like that's what I see people saying. I don't see them saying that they are more scared or more vigilant. I see them saying that they feel like enraged that this injustice happened, or they understand that like they shouldn't defer on getting the raise at work because they are just as competent as the dude who got it in the next cube over. I mean,
that is a wild set of connections
it is,
to draw.
You I'm going to send you the thread that I'm actually looking at okay. right now, which seems like a stretch to me too, but that is the way people feel. And to me, the thing about a podcast, and I review podcasts for a living, is it is not always about what it is. It's often more important about how it makes the listener feel. It's an incredibly intimate experience listening to a podcast, much more so than watching a TV show. And if you feel some sort of joy or empowerment or fascination, I mean, it's a gut reaction that these fans are having to this show.
Yes. Thank you. That is what I wanted someone to say. Yes. It is not, it's like not a literal dissection of the show. It's not like a critical dissection of the show is never going to get you to the right place. It's just an analysis of like, they have a ginormous, enormous audience. It's huge.
It's very huge.
Huge.
Very, very huge.
Audience. Yeah. And so it's people are responding to something. Okay, listeners, if there are any murderinos or murderino haters among you, please write in xxgabfest@slate.com or tweet at June Thomas, at Noreen Malone, at Hannah Rosen, and let us know what you think. Rebecca, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for including me.
Yes, and everybody listen to Rebecca's podcast, Crime Writers On, and also the Slate podcast, Mom and Dad Are Fighting. All right, guys, let's talk about Ireland. Ireland voted this week to repeal its ban on abortion, and the vote was not at all close. It was overwhelmingly in favor of repeal. This after recently voting to legalize same-sex marriage and after electing a gay prime minister. We discuss what this means for Ireland and how a similar thing might play out in the U.S. So, Noreen, let's set up this topic. What did the Constitution used to say, and what did it get changed to?
Well, so interestingly, Ireland didn't have this ban on abortion until 1983, and the ban basically said that the fetus's right to life is equal to that of a pregnant woman. And so this, you know, Ireland has been sort of liberalizing gradually and then very fast over basically since 1983. You know, divorce was illegal until 1995, which is like a pretty crazy fact. But the real impetus for this current movement to repeal that was the death a few years ago in 2012 of a 31-year-old dentist named Savita Halapanavar, who died of complications from a miscarriage after she couldn't get an abortion in the country. So basically what this vote has done is roll back that 1983 amendment to the Constitution. And now the fight that will happen in Ireland is defining what are the terms of abortion, right? Or the terms of legal abortion. So it seems there's been some signaling that abortion will be legal up to 12 weeks. So it's sort of a chance for the country to collectively think, or the legislators to collectively think about, you know, what modern regulation would look like on that.
Especially a modern regulation will look like after 2/3 of the country decided mm-hmm. that they are, oh, I mean, it's hard to put this in words, like, are okay with abortion, want women to have the right to control their pregnancies.
And those votes really broke down on age, right? Yeah, yeah. Younger people, not even young at this point, but just younger people really overwhelmingly voted to repeal this. And people were, I mean, something that I found actually kind of moving on Twitter watching it happen was people, it was the hashtag home to vote.
Yeah.
People who were expats had all come back to Ireland to vote in this election because it felt so important to them.
And which had an extra valence too, because forever, actually, long before 1983, Irish women have been going to Britain and to other places to get abortions. You know, they've been leaving Ireland to, you know, to deal with this thing. And now women were going back to vote to give women that right.
So, June, what do you make of the sudden cracking open of Ireland? I mean, from over here on our coast, it seems sudden. You know, it seems like just one day everyone was like, done with you, Catholic Church, and your authority. I mean, you can write the history as like, there was the sex abuse scandals. Yeah. And then, you know, whatever natural authority the church was losing, just because it's over there in Europe and it didn't seem sustainable, it just suddenly like collapsed. And then kind of one thing after another, but it happened so quickly. Were you surprised by it? Like, did you, in your mind, was Ireland and also Northern Ireland always fixed as places that would be just different from the rest of Europe?
Well, I mean, let's separate Northern Ireland and we can get to that in a second. Obviously, that's
okay.
That's a complicated issue to separate Northern Ireland, June.
Exactly. I heard your sister having this conversation on the 538 podcast.
Oh, really?
This week. Yes.
Oh, interesting.
I mean, and I should just say that as someone who grew up in Britain in the 70s and early 80s, my expertise is certainly not in Ireland. I grew up with lots of very wrong-headed views of Ireland's terrible stereotypes, and I'm no expert in Ireland. I've only been there once. But I think clearly there was this incredibly powerful institution, the church, that whose influence seems to have waned enormously. Largely because, I think, of what you mentioned, the sexual abuse scandals. Like, how can an institution that has controlled a country have these revelations, have these things revealed about the horrible, heinous things that they've been doing and still maintain their authority? It's just not possible. And I do think that that's what's happened. And also the opening up of the country, it was something of a closed country that, you know, people didn't traditionally move to. People used to leave Ireland. And now it's a very international, somewhat diverse country, certainly in ways that it didn't used to be. So a lot has changed in Ireland. But the thing that is, you know, obsessive to me is the fact that in Northern Ireland, which for the moment remains part of the United Kingdom, it's the only place in either the Republic of Ireland or the United Kingdom that doesn't recognize same-sex marriage, that now outlaws abortion. And this to me is a sign of what's conservatism is now around Protestantism. If you look at the Irish vote on Friday, only one Irish county voted against the referendum, which is said to keep the ban on abortion. And that was Donegal, which is the county which shares the biggest border with Northern Ireland. Like, there's something, you know, in Northern Ireland, it's based on sectarian lines, and there's nothing that the Brits can do, because not only is the history of Brits meddling in Northern Ireland very fraught, but also Theresa May is relying on the DUP, the Democratic Unionist Party, which is a very right-wing, very religious, very conservative Protestant party, to keep her government alive. So there's no influence that can be exerted. And those buggers in Northern Ireland, who really are horrible people, are are you know, they're this terrible.
Maureen, are we just supposed to like, because we're too dumb to know the inside?
No.
Well, we're just supposed to like, we don't know. So we're like, sure, they must be terrible people.
Well, Hannah, I'm Irish American, so I actually have opinions on this that I'm going to bite my tongue on. But what's interesting to me about the Irish trajectory as opposed to the rest of Europe, I mean, the rest of Northern Europe, and I guess Europe more broadly, has gone totally rightward in recent decades, right? Britain, Brexit, like all the sort of gross, like neo-Nazi stuff that's happening in large swaths of Europe, the shift is mostly rightward. So what's different about Ireland? I mean, I think there's an interesting thing that's happening, which is that many of these countries that are becoming more closed and more like more obsessed with ethnicity and like what is real British, what is real Polish or whatever in this very creepy way, those are countries that, you know, have been in the business of empire building in the past. And Ireland, you know, was an occupied country. And I think there is something in the national, there's something in the national character that's happening there. But on the Catholic Church specifically, right?
Right. Which I was going to say, because one of the countries that has not had that path is Spain, which was also a country that was dominated by the Catholic Church and is more liberal and more open now.
Yeah.
So, you know, I think actually the Catholic Church is, there's something specific about what happened in the church.
Right. I mean, and I don't know as much about Spain. You know a lot about Spain. But in Ireland specifically, it wasn't just the church sex abuse scandals, actually, that I think turned a lot of people against, you know, the total control of the church. And it should be said that, like, Ireland is still hugely Catholic. And even there are plenty of people who consider themselves Catholics in good standing and have some kind of broader affiliation with the church that isn't maybe so, like, practicing, but, you know, are in favor of legal abortion. Anyway, another thing at play in Ireland is that there were these Magdalene orphanages, right, where there were, you know, teenage girls who got pregnant were sent away, and there are these horrible abuses that have come to light in these orphanages. So there's really like a whole generation that is reckoning with, and that's really recent history too. So mm-hmm. there's this whole generation that's reckoning with that kind of like shame and tragedy that's inflicted as a result of the shame around sex in Ireland. And so I think this is a reaction to that, a pretty pure reaction.
I love the way this story. Story just echoed and resonated. And I think it's because of what you said, Noreen. It's like, oh, a blast from the past. Like, this is a situation where globalization and progress and, you know, liberalism, it all just moves in tandem. It felt like a little move forward. The one thing that bummed me out a little about how this played out is a lot of the stuff you mentioned, Noreen, the argument by anecdote. It was an argument by horror story. Mm-hmm. Like this woman who died by sepsis and these terrible things that the church did. And the reason it bummed me out is because still nobody is able to make the defense. This is Kathla Pollitt's argument in her book Pro, that abortion is an engine of progress and rights for women. For some reason, that's still a difficult argument to make. And my Irish friend Brian, hi Brian, who's a longtime Double X listener. I was asking him what it felt like, and he said it was a little different than the gay rights vote. Like the gay rights vote was like jubilant, like just, you know, like just jumping in the streets. Whereas this was kind of progress, but it was a little more sober. Like people are just a little more conflicted about this one. And I was struck about how difficult it is anywhere in the U.S. too, to just say abortion is very important as an engine of equality for women.
Yeah, that's because a lot of people have complicated feelings about like the medical act of abortion and what that constitutes, particularly people who, you know, have been raised under a value system like that of the Catholic Church. Like it's not as clear as saying like two people love each other. Why are we going to stand in the way? Right. And
right.
You know, that even people who firmly believe that abortion should be legal have conflicted feelings about different, you know, stopping points for its legality, et cetera, et cetera.
So just for the last minute of this segment, just to put this in a U.S. context, I was thinking, you know, would you want something like that here? You would not. You would not want a referendum because referendums run state by state, because there's a lot of states that use basically medical, technological advances to push forth the idea that is in the that is enshrined in the original Irish Constitution that just got overturned, which is that a fetus, you know, like the heartbeat law in Iowa, it would be a terrible idea here. Like, we wouldn't get that kind of popular response. You would just get civil war.
I mean, I think the fact that, you know, that's one of the reasons we're all saying Ireland people, Ireland, is that I think maybe we assume too much about people's attitudes. I mean, it's clear that there have been in so many states what to me seem like awful kind of restrictions on women's freedom, on women's health by, you know, anti-abortion groups. And clearly they have enough power that they can push those through. But, you know, it's kind of like the Northern Ireland situation. You know, sometimes democracy has weird effects. And I wonder if we are kind of self-defeating, if maybe if there was something like just a one person, one vote, we count them all up, referendum, are we wrong to think that women's rights wouldn't be recognized? I just wonder.
Well, and also Ireland is so much more of a monoculture than the U.S. Even with the amount that it has changed and immigrants have come in the last, you know, couple of decades, it really is like the Catholic Church remains the dominant institution, and you can't point to any one thing like that in the United States, right? Like Protestantism, like, you know, in the founders' days was that, but it's so fractured, and then like the Catholic Church. Maybe I'm wrong on this, but I don't think that's actually what's driving fully the pro-life movement in this country. I think it's much more evangelicalism, yeah. And that's a complicated beast of its own. That, like, I just think that it's easier to move the needle culturally in a country like Ireland, which is a lot smaller, and people are reacting mostly against the same thing. Like, someone in Alabama who's deeply religious is going to just have a different way of understanding this than someone in, you know, Maine who's deeply religious in a different, you know, version of Protestantism. I don't know. I just think it's a lot harder here.
Huh. Okay. So clearly June and Noreen need a trip to the Deep South. For the rest of our listeners,
Southern road trip for vacation a couple summers ago, Hannah, I will have you know, ate some good barbecue.
And I spent 4 days in Alabama once.
I'm sure you did. I'm sure you did all the hipster spots down in the South. So if you listeners are Irish, especially if you travel to Ireland for the vote or have local insights to share with us, please do XXGabFest@slate.com or tweet at one of us. All right, our next topic, Killing Eve, is a BBC America series about a psychopathic contract killer and the British female agents who hunt her down. Like My Favorite Murder, which we just discussed, it has a kind of murder is fun and sexy vibe, which we will discuss. The show is created by Phoebe Waller-Bridge. We are all fans. She created Fleabag, and it's a show that takes on some of her favorite themes, women's cruelty, obsession with other women, and just women who in all kinds of ways do not behave in the usual female stereotype way. And by the way, listeners, we are only going to talk vaguely about plot points, so we're going to be careful not to spoil, and especially not to spoil anything past the fourth episode. June, why don't we start by your telling us about some the two main characters? Who's what's the face off in this show? Are the two women?
So the two women who are, you know, so the title kind of sets it up. Eve is Eve Pilastri, played by Sandra Oh. Who, yes, is actually Canadian, but speaks with a, you know, North American accent, but has a little bit of a not terribly convincing backstory that explains why she works for MI5 and is actually British, even though she, to all intents and purposes, sounds very American. And she is an MI5 agent who kind of has a desk job. She's not involved in any kinds of spying. She kind of organizes things, keeps monitoring on people. And then something happens and she has a kind of a ongoing obsession with female murderers. You know, she's the kind of woman who has a very well flipped through copy of Women Who Kill under her bed.
Do you think she would have been a murderer, you know?
Probably, yes, she would. Her team, by a weird but very well sprung process, becomes aware of a female killer, a contract killer, known we learn later as Villanelle. She is played by the amazing young actress Jodie Comer, who I just have to take a side note to as a proud Northerner to say is this woman from Liverpool who is, by my estimation, a working class woman from Liverpool who, when you hear her real voice, is like, she's like a really, you know, she's a real Liverpudlian, you know what I mean?
Oh, really?
You know, yeah. And she, like...
Do you keep doing it in that voice?
I'll just do the whole show in this Liverpudlian accent, yeah. So, yeah, you know, basically her normal voice is like a Beatle. And yet she, so she plays this woman, Villanelle, who we learn is actually a Russian, but she's, you know, she lives in Paris, she speaks many languages, and there's, and she's very young and attractive, and she is a cold-blooded murderer. And she murders people so well, so with such verve, with such style. And she is... The, you know, the kind of the underlying story is this weird kind of international conspiracy involving Russians. And I mean, honestly, that part of it is not terribly well thought out, but it doesn't really matter. Because for me, the thing that's so attractive about this show is like, you don't really question things. Like there were some crimes against storytelling in the final episodes, but it doesn't really matter because it's so stylish. And the kind of, oh, and this, I forgot to mention this amazing thing, which is Villanelle sleeps with both men and women, but she seems to be romantically connected. Her romantic attractions are to women, and typically it seems a specific kind of woman, which is a sort of a middle-aged woman with big hair, which is, you know, again, it's like it's a wish fulfillment for a lot of middle-aged women. And typically also kind of straight women. And that's just another strange element. And Eve is very sort of attracted in a, not quite in the same way, but there is this, what Rachel Syme in The New Republic, I think, got exactly the right word. They're kind of magnetized by each other. It's really the entire show is about that kind of push-pull between them, and that, as Willa said in her review in Slate, that it's a cat and mouse story in which they're both the cat and they're both the mouse.
Something about the way June was said. For seeing the everybody use earnestly cat and mouse, every single
exactly.
review used that term,
exactly.
cat and mouse. And then June was like earnestly like, they're both the cat.
Both the mouse.
And both the mouse. That's, you know, I never thought of the middle-aged woman wish fulfillment.
Oh my
you know,
God.
The fact that these women are in their sort of near 50s and they're treated in this show as an object of intense sexual desire
yeah.
by the most, you know, kind of badass
and
woman
most
in
classically
the world. Now,
beautiful type of woman. To me, like, this whole thing was all wish fulfillment. Like, as somebody who speaks a few languages, think, I could be a fucking spy. I could be an international right. killer. I think, actually, I can't right. drive, I can't swim. Probably I'm not really going to be much of an international guy. I have no upper body strength. But somehow, like, I'm pretty much like Villanelle. I'm just like Sandra Oh, except, well, not in any way at all. But, you know, it's like you really do feel like I could be part of this great game.
And that's such a brilliant theory, because their obsession with each other is also wish fulfillment,
yeah.
entirely wish fulfillment. Like, you know, the Eve's obsession with Villanelle is that she lives this mundane life in which she sits at home and fantasizes about murderers and female murderers. And here she has her one chance to catch a female murderer and be around her in these amazing scenes where it's like, I think about you all the time kind of thing. And then Villanelle's obsession with Eve and the other middle-aged woman, which is, you know, basically inexplicable because she has all these beautiful lovers in and out of her Parisian apartment. It doesn't totally make sense why she'd be obsessed with a middle-aged woman, is about kind of, you know, human normalcy. Like, she's a psychopath. She doesn't understand. She never had a family of her own. You know, the little we know about her backstory is a lot of damage. She's also a psychopath. And so she's just kind of like inhaling what like femaleness would be, like what it would be like to have kind of earthy femaleness with a husband. And
can I just say, Hannah, bite your tongue. First of all, there is nothing weird about Villanelle's obsession. Of course it could happen to anybody. The heart wants what the heart wants. There's nothing weird about
also,
that.
Also, Hannah, you're kind of her type.
You've got the hair.
You've got the hair.
I know. I'm the age of these women and I have their hair. I was like, I've been watching it for, you know, a couple of weeks now, like looking around like, who's my Villanelle? Ladies, step up. V.
Can I tell you guys my big theory about the show?
Yes.
I think it is a show that is in part about the inherent psychopathy of the manic pixie dream girl. Like, I think Villanelle is actually kind of a riff on that. So yeah. She does all these things that, like, you could see presented in another light. She would be this, like, character who just flits into your life and, like, makes things better. She's mysterious. You don't know a ton about her, but you don't need to, you know. She dresses beautifully. She does, like, really quirky, fun things, like sending you a suitcase full of clothes, like, all in your size of your favorite designer. She, like, flits around in a big pink poofy ball gown when it's not there. She has a whole, you know, refrigerator of just filled with champagne.
My dream, by the way.
Right, exactly. This is, like, it's, like, the female manic pixie dream girl. But then there's something, there's like this crazy hole at her core. There's no, if someone exists to like beguile and just like, you know, sort of interest another person, what's there? And then this sort of genius twist that Phoebe Waller-Bridge has given is like, oh, what's there? She's going to kill you. Like, she doesn't give a shit. She's going to kill you.
Genius. Yeah. Oh my God. So many good theories.
I love this show.
I love that.
Yeah.
That's such a good theory. What, you know, you guys had such a powerfully negative reaction to stylizing murder in My Favorite Murder.
I know.
This is some really stylized murder. I mean, you know, it's self-aware stylized murder because she actually watches the bodies after she's killed them. She's interested in the moment of death. She's interested in the kind of blood spilling out. She's interested in the kind of aesthetics of what a dead body looks like after she's killed it. So it's very self-aware in its stylizedness, but it's very, you know, dismissive of the infinite murders that she is committing throughout the show.
Well, I have two responses to that. One, I am a giant hypocrite.
And this style buys you off easy.
Totally. Like, as this is just a beautifully done, like thing, and I had a total aesthetic response to it. But two, it's fiction and it's treated like in a different way. But yeah, I'm a hypocrite. I'm not against true crime. I'm just against a certain treatment of true crime and a certain lack of whatever.
But I think, Hannah, that what you are saying about how things that would typically bug us don't bug us here. There's something really powerful about and it is about the style and it's about the humor. Like, another big kind of theme of the show is about don't underestimate women. I mean, sometimes it's, again, as some of the critics pointed out, like, it's literal, like in an early episode, so I think we can spoil it. Like, somebody underestimates, a man underestimates Villanelle, goes much too close to her and suffers for it in the, you know, pays the ultimate price for his under, you know, just not taking her seriously enough. So yeah, we are constantly having the rug pulled out from under us. But I think the nature of her obsessions with Eve, with another older woman with whom she's obsessed, who looks very much like Eve, there's no reason for her to use those people. Like, she shouldn't be doing what she does with Eve. You know, there's no reason for her to send things to that woman. There's no, like, operational reason for her to do that. So I think we read that as being a genuine obsession, a genuine attraction.
Or just a hobby that she likes to play with people, you know?
Yeah, maybe so.
Yeah. And it's not like she doesn't walk about the earth as a damaged person. It's not quite like Basic Instinct. I mean, one of the fascinating things about watching her is she is utterly devoid of empathy. I mean, she's a psychopath, but it's just kind of amazing to watch a woman who doesn't care. Like, she has this, in an early episode, this very sweet guy who's interested in her. He dies. She doesn't
care.
He
dies. She kills
him. Like, not for one second. She kills him. So it's interesting to watch a woman who has absolutely zero female empathy or caretaking. I mean, she has a little bit.
She can play it, though. I mean, like, she uses it. She can make bonds with people very quickly, which requires a certain kind of empathy. She's faking it. She's an actress. But you have to kind of know what's involved to act it out.
Well, listeners, you should check out Killing Eve if you haven't already. Start from the beginning and share your thoughts with us at XXGabTest@slate.com. We would love to hear from fans and non-fans of the show. Particularly if you make it to the end. We'd love to hear about the final episode, which we haven't talked about, but I'm very curious about people's views on that.
Can I just say, too, if you haven't watched it, please don't be afraid of seeing really gory things, because even though she does, we are told, murder people very sometimes quite in graphic ways, the show is not graphic and actually hides the violence.
Yeah, I have a weak stomach for that kind of thing, and I was able to watch it.
All right, ladies, let's move on to our recommendations. Noreen Malone, what do you got?
I have two recommendations this week. One is an article from the magazine that I work for by the great genius Jessica Pressler.
So good.
So good. If you have not yet read this, the title of the article is called Maybe She Had So Much Money She Just Lost Track of It. And the female grifter is its own kind of wonderful archetype. And Jessica told the story of a woman named Anna Delvey, who claimed to be of German origin and moved to New York City and began just sort of inserting herself in high society among these ridiculous people who just took her at face value. And she went to the right parties and she hired the right trainer, and she was a con man. She was floating checks. She was trying to get investors. She was not the real deal. And it's just an amazing telling of this, and the details are insane, and it makes you think that New York is like a little bit corrupt at the heart of it. But what a fun parade to watch. So that's one thing. And then the other thing I want to recommend is a book that's a few years old. It's Rachel Kushner's The Flamethrowers. Rachel Kushner has another book coming out that I...
Which is my recommendation. The Mars Oh, one,
okay.
So good.
Yes. Well, tell me why I should read it, because I'm not as... interested just by the plot summary. So I went back and read The Flamethrowers, which I had avoided reading, I think out of some kind of like allergy to the coverage of it. Like, she was always photographed like with red lipstick in front of her car or her motorcycle. And like, there was just a lot of like, oh, like, it, you know, it's about New York in the 70s. And I'm sick of people talking about New York in the 70s. But I was an idiot. This book is just really, really stunning. It is about a woman named Reno who comes to New York to be an artist from Nevada. She is sort of an interesting cipher at the center of it, and she falls in with this group of older male artists, sort of swaggering egotists, and one of them, her boyfriend for a time, is you know, this wealthy heir to a motorcycle company, Reno, Italian motorcycle company. Reno herself drives motorcycles. There is like a subplot of, you know, Italian worker demonstrations. There is like a beautiful time in Italy that also has this sort of like Elena Ferrante-ish kind of, you know, Marxist demonstration. This book has it all, and the writing itself is really good. Just like, she, the narrator, sort of observes the right things and surprises you all the time. And I have just been totally sucked into this novel, and I am an idiot for judging those press photos. Rachel Kushner, what a great writer. That's all.
Well, but that's the reason she's a great writer. We did an audio book club on Slate, by the way, about that book.
Oh, so I should listen.
If you need to consume more, you should listen to it. The Mars Room is the same way. It's about sort of excess, and, you know, you read things like prison and lap dances, but she's such a close and tight observer. So I think it's the combination of those things that makes her writing really amazing. It's like the loose, indulgent topics matched with the incredible observation and the very tight, beautiful writing. So the same is true of The Mars Room, which is my recommendation.
I'm sorry, what is that book called?
The Mars Room. Do I have an accent?
No, I'd not heard of it, and I couldn't figure, like, those words on their face don't have anything.
Le Chambre de Mars.
Le Chambre de Mars.
Yeah. All right, June, what's yours?
Mine is weird. Weird for me. It's like something that I didn't think until a few weeks ago I would have the slightest bit of interest in. But as part of the process of offering feedback on the next episode of Willa Paskin's amazing new podcast, Decodering, which will be out next Monday, I have developed an interest, not in the Sherlock Holmes stories, about which I have never cared. When I was young, I tried to like read these things or become familiar with certain bits of culture that I thought were necessary, like these middle class accoutrements that you had to be familiar with because that's how you showed you were smart, like Sherlock Holmes and Bob Dylan and I don't know, Virginia Woolf. And I just never could get along with any of them. But Willa's podcast, Decodering, is about kind of fandom and how fandom can curdle. And in her talking about the history of like Sherlock Holmes fandom, I was in the library and I just kind of came across this book. It's actually translated from Swedish, but it's called From Holmes to Sherlock, and it's by this guy, Matthias Boström. Apologies to the Swedes if I just mangled his name. But it is literally about like the path, how Sherlock Holmes went from being a character in some stories written by Arthur Conan Doyle to just a phenomenon of that there are so much, you know, so many new stories, so many treatments, so many versions of this guy, so many arguments about what he represents. And so I'm really loving this big book about Sherlock Holmes. And I guess if you know the basic outlines, probably there's not a lot new, but it's really well written. And good work, translator of Matthias Boström from Swedish. So From Holmes to Sherlock.
All right. Great recommendations. That is our show for today. Thanks to our producer, Verilyn Williams, our production assistant, Daniel Schrader. Please tweet us at June Thomas, at Noreen Malone, or at Hannah Rosen to send us your thoughts and ideas. We are still taking show names, although not for very much longer. So if you have any brilliant inspirations, please send them to us or email us at doublexgabfest@slate.com. For June and Noreen, I'm Hannah Rosen, and we will talk to you again in 2 weeks.